Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In 2016, the city of Mumbai was blanketed in toxic smog. The source? Fires at the nearby dumping ground of Deonar, the country's oldest. The Deonar fire became an embarrassment for Mumbai, coming right before International Expo meant to announce the city to international investors and businesses. Law enforcement immediately blamed scrap dealers who lived alongside the landfill. These dealers are men and women, poor, sometimes quite young, who comb the mountain for waste that can be resold: metal, plastic, cloth, and if they're lucky, gold and jewelry. Soumya Roy's Mountain Tales, Love and Loss in the Municipality of Castaway Belongings looks into the lives of a few of these pickers as they try to survive among the mountains of trash, as government officials and judges squabble above them, trying to figure out what to do. Soumya Roy is a journalist and activist based in Mumbai. In 2010, she co-founded Vandana Foundation to support the livelihoods of Mumbai's poorest micro-entrepreneurs. Through this, she met the community who depend on Deonar. Her writing has appeared in Forbes India magazine, WSJ.com, and Bloomberg News, among others. And she contributed a chapter to Dharavi, The Cities Within, an anthology of essays on Asia's largest slum. In this interview, we'll talk about the trash mountains of Deonar, the families that live there, and how they navigate life on the fringes of one of India's largest cities. So, Soumya, thank you so much for joining us today. Maybe let's start with a basic question. Where is Deonar, and what quote-unquote role does it play in the city of Mumbai?
Nicholas, thank you very much for having me on your show. It's an absolute pleasure to be here and to be speaking with you. So Deonar is at the edge of the city. It's very much in the city. As you can imagine, as the city has expanded, it's when Deonar was planned in 1896, it was seen as outside the city. It's referred to as the village of Deonar in colonial records. So very much something outside the city. And yet over these 120, 23 years, it has the city has grown, and it has almost enveloped these dumping grounds. They are about 300. They were originally 823 acres, but they are now about 300 acres. And when you think of a landfill, you think it literally means that something it's subterranean, right? Something is dug and garbage is filled into it. But in fact, over this 1.25 centuries, what's happened is that garbage is, it was a swamp, what was a swampy marsh meant to be filled with garbage has now become garbage mountains that are 120 feet in height, like 18-story buildings. All the city is detritus. And I remember when I first walked there, seeing everything we consumed, almost like a map of our lives, mashed with mud, compacted with mud, making these mountains that were like 20 stories high, like buildings. And it's at the edge of this island city. And so, the sea, the creek surrounds it on three sides. And these garbage mountains edged by the sea, made of everything that we have consumed, from, food boxes to clothes to shoes to plastic bottles of water to styrofoam cups of coffee. And I always heard stories of how, gold came there, jewelry came there, notes came there, purses came there, metal wires, gadgets, everything that we consumed, and the changing patterns of everything we consumed ended up there. So the role that it plays is that it just consumes everything that we cast away, allowing us to consume more and acquire more.
So Deonar is Mumbai's kind of oldest dumping ground. Could you talk a bit about the history that led to the creation of the landfill?
Yeah, sure. Someone was telling me the other day that this place is at this point bookended by two epidemics, two plagues, if we may call it so. So this particular dumping ground was planned in 1896 when a plague raged in the city. at that point, it was supposed to have come with rats on a trading ship from China. And so it was getting, the rats were carrying it through, you know, filth, you know, garbage in the city. And, you know, as the city was growing, the colonial city at that point, there was increasing garbage and the rats were spreading the illness through the city. And the colonial authorities at the time also tried quarantine and they tried searching people for buboes, physical searches, which led to a lot of unrest in the city. It led to migration from the city. It led to violence. It led to riots. It led to murder of colonial authorities in Pune, which is a neighboring city. And so that increasing unrest became almost, you know, difficult to deal with. And so the government decided that it was better to just evacuate trash from the city, which became a way of dealing with the plague. And so they acquired this marshy swamp of around 823 acres in June 1897, if I remember correctly. And they made a train called the Kachra train or the trash train, a train line and garbage wagons or train wagons filled with the city's garbage began going there once in the morning, once in the evening, filled with all the city's trash, allowing the city to be clean, allowing it to be rebuilt, and allowing trash to fill up in the swamp. And that is how Deonar was planned. And the colonial authorities at the time thought this was this would be a profitable scheme very soon, because in 25 years, when the swamp was filled, they would rent it out to farmers because the garbage would fertilize the soil and farmers would pay them up to 1 lakh rupees every year. What happened instead was that, as it happens often with garbage, that this place just became a forgotten outpost of the city. Until many, many years later, when the government court cases began, and the government turned around and found that this was no more just a swamp, it was in fact garbage mountains.
And it's interesting, I remember reading that chapter of your book, and kind of, there's some interesting parallels to today when it comes to public health and governments trying to figure out how to handle public health. I think, I believe, what is it? There's a chapter where I think the community goes to the colonial authorities, be like, you have to rescind all of these quarantine orders because people are very scared. They're freaking out and the city will, like, I guess, go into riots if you don't, which of course leads to some interesting parallels to today's public health orders.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In fact, at this time, I think people were asked to stay home, but at the time, people were being taken to hospital for quarantine. Families of plague victims were being kept in hospitals to be quarantined. And, you know, in Indian, there was greater sort of, what do you say, it led to misunderstandings because the colonial government, you know, the municipal government was colonial and British, and the people they of the city were mostly Indian, right? So that increased the mistrust, and there were all kinds of beliefs that they were being taken to hospital only to die, you know, that they would be kept there alone. And so people were actually protecting ill people with, say, knives, so that they would not be taken to hospital. And eventually the colonial government realizes that the best way is to work with residents of the city. So they sort of rescind their quarantine measures and they begin to work with residents of the city. And I think this is something that maybe even this time in the quarantine involving city residents in these measures has certainly helped to ensure their effectiveness. So there are certainly parallels with that plague and this one, I would say.
So let's move on to the scrap dealers, the pickers living in Deonar. What exactly are they doing in the landfill, and how are they earning a living day to day?
Sure. So they will begin by just walking up the garbage mountains. At one point, now it's reduced, but at one point there would be something like 1,000 trucks filled with garbage. So you get coming in and emptying on these garbage mountains, which were they just pressed down with mud to hold them in place, right? So you can imagine that incessant coming of garbage through the day and through the night, and waste pickers would basically be, just filling this garbage into their everything they could, into their arms and on their heads, and bringing it back down into the little lanes that they live in just below the garbage mountains, and then come home and sort through it plastic for plastic, different kinds of plastic, the thick and the thin, and maybe cloth scraps. The older waste pickers would often pick cloth scraps, but as we began to wear more ready-made clothes, cloth scraps which came from tailors' shops shrank on the garbage mountains. But they may also pick little bits of glass, as one of the characters in the book was a glass trader, Jahangir. They may pick metal, which is the most expensive of the finds on the garbage mountains, because you can resell it, but it's also quite elusive because it stays under lighter garbage such as plastic. So they pick all of these different things and then sell it to garbage traders, who then sell it on and from where it may be exported, or it might be squashed and made into new things, like say plastic might be made into t-shirts, it might be made into new bottles, it might be made into pellets or packaging. And so they sell it and they earn what they can by selling this as raw material, like by the kilo, plastic by the kilo or glass by the kilo. And this is how they make a living every day. And every once in a while, mashed in all the garbage, they may find a bit of somebody's forgotten notes, currency notes. They may find ready-to-eat packages of food that they may cook and eat. They may find clothes that they wear. So it's money, but it's also their life is intertwined with this place and this garbage.
So to kind of talk about you and your story a little bit, what brought you in contact with the people of Deonar?
Oh, yeah. So I was a journalist for many years. Then in 2010, I started a nonprofit to work on supporting livelihoods of micro entrepreneurs across the city and in some rural areas where farmer suicides are going on. And so we used to give microfinance loans to micro entrepreneurs across the city. So it could be cobblers, it could be women who make lunches, who do some tailoring work. So maybe a loan to buy a tailoring machine, or people who make all the shoes in the city, people who make Bombay's famous street food. So we were lending to all of them as a nonprofit to grow their businesses. And in 2013, we began getting the waste pickers of Deonar, and I was immediately skeptical that, like, what kind of business is this? What kind of place is this? I had heard about it but never seen it, and I thought our loans would go bad, because I said that you can only pick what you can with your hands. How are you going to grow your business? And they began getting you have no idea, like, this is never going to run out of work. This is like this amazing growing opportunity. Waste is never going to reduce. Waste is always going to increase. These garbage mountains have grown before our eyes. So we are going to grow our business. They began bringing photographs to show me. They began bringing videos. Then I began following them at first just as a microfinance lender. But then in 2016, when the fires happen and waste pickers, police cases began getting made against waste pickers for lighting these fires. So I thought that, yes, it's possible that they lit these fires. I don't know. But I thought I would write a magazine story to show that we in the city had a connection, that we had made this combustible place, that this was now so big, so huge, and so combustible, with so much waste lying there, that waste pickers said that even if you threw a cigarette, it could light up in a little bit of a fire. Or if you see municipal records, they say that this place lights up in spontaneous combustion, because there is so much waste lying there. City waste lying there. So I thought I would write a magazine story to show that we made this combustible place. But then as I began researching, it just grew and grew and grew, and then became, this several years long project, which became a book.
So let's talk about some of the individual waste pickers you talk about in Mountain Tales. And specifically, kind of your book focuses on, let's say, one. Well, there are a few families that are kind of the focus. But insofar as your book has kind of a few central characters, it's people like Farzana, it's people like Haider Ali, it's people like Jahangir, this family who's trying to kind of figure out how to live among the Trash Mountains. I wonder if you might kind of talk about a few of those waste pickers, kind of what's driving them personally.
Sure. I think you're right. I mean, it does. There were four families that I followed, but most of all, I would say that it was Haider Ali's family and his daughter Farzana, around whom this book is centered. They're trying to make a better life for themselves. Haider Ali first came to me among the first waste pickers who took loans from us, and his plan was to do something other than picking waste. He had learned embroidery as a child, worked in an embroidery workshop, and in the end come to work on the garbage mountains because they never ran out of work. He had made many, many attempts to leave and to do something else, but in the end continued to work on the garbage mountains. So he again wanted to take a loan and he wanted to leave and start an embroidery workshop. And I thought I would write about him, but it became increasingly clear to me as I began reporting the book that the book would be about his daughter, Farzana. Farzana was born at the feet of the garbage mountains soon after her father moved there. She's the sixth of his nine children. And so with her, we could see, you know, she was born at the feet of the garbage mountains, began walking, learned to walk on the garbage mountain slopes. She found her first toys there, began to, you know, eat all her favorite food, found her favorite foods there, found her first pair of jeans there. All her friends were there. She would, you know, she just couldn't leave this place. This is where she was growing. So it was almost a coming of age story on the garbage mountains. And we could see the arc of the garbage mountains through her, because when these fires began in 2016, it was almost as if Farzana had inhaled these fires, which she had worked through them. She kept working, she kept picking waste, she couldn't stop, even though the fires were raging. Her father was not working so much through the fires, but she was. Often when I would go to their house at that point, I would see her coming back with warm metal she had collected, her feet scalded with blistered by walking the burning mountains, but she could not stop. And that seems to have had some impact on her health, on her mental health, and yet she was continuing, and had pretty sort of devastating impact on her, and yet she was continuing to work. So I felt that we could see the arc of the garbage mountains, of the city's attempt to manage its waste, through her life. And so the book really came to center around her a lot.
There's a good segue here. We talked about kind of that there's something about working on the mountain that kind of draws people to it, kind of despite people saying, no, I want to leave. I want my children to leave, get a better life, get education. There's something about the nature of the community where they're living, the nature of waste picking, that makes it seems like it makes it very difficult to escape for several of the inhabitants of Dayanar. I wonder if you might get into that a little bit and maybe kind of share your thoughts as to why several of its residents seem to be stuck in a way.
Yeah, I would say that for two reasons. One is that the lack of social mobility. These are not people with a lot of education. And so, you know, when you stand on the garbage mountains, there's the creek, and across the creek, you do see these gleaming new buildings that house, say, tech companies, call centers, etc. But these are not people who can take jobs like that and retain jobs like that. They don't have, many of them have dropped out of school. The gravitational pull of the garbage mountains is pretty strong. And so many of them would talk to me about their attempts to leave and take up other jobs, but their ability to get these jobs and to last in these jobs is sort of pretty limited. And also the gravitational pull of the garbage mountains is pretty strong. So if you were to see, while there are a large number of government school, municipal schools in this ward, dropout rate is really high because you can work even as a child for an hour or two on the garbage mountains and earn enough to buy a snack, to buy some, you know, something to sniff and to keep working. And so, or to keep your family, you know, to keep your home running, to hand over to your family so you can keep your home running, to buy a meal for your family, to buy some medicines for your family. And so most children in that area begin working on the garbage mountains pretty young, which we also see with Farzana. Like, she was working on the garbage mountains pretty much since she could walk, collecting things, bringing them down so her family could sell them, could buy some food, could buy some, you know, supplies for the house. And so they begin working there so early on that their education gets compromised, their health gets compromised. They are often, you know, and they often with boys especially, you see addictions, which make it increasingly difficult then to leave and to do other kinds of things. So it's a trap from both ends, where jobs in the city are also not so available to them, but their ability to get those jobs is limited, because this is the cycle that it's an intergenerational cycle also that they're stuck in, of poverty, of malnutrition, of marginalization, I suppose.
Now, you know, as you read through the book, Farzana faces a lot of misfortune, you know, I think terrible accidents, leading to kind of quite long-standing injuries, illness. Obviously, they live next to a landfill, so they're clearly health problems. And a lot of her misfortunes are blamed on kind of spirits and possession. Are those beliefs kind of widely held among communities like the Pickers of Dayanar? And kind of where did these beliefs come from? I guess come from in terms of like a history or kind of the cultural history of the area.
Right since I began working with waste pickers, they would tell me sometimes that, oh, you know, they when they say they made a house, like most houses in these lanes are made of, say, plastic, it waste that they brought down from the garbage mountains, right? So they would say, oh, there was a kabis or a large spirit floating in my house, and the spirit said that this was my space, and, you know, you need to pay me rent for using this space. And so as obviously having a background in journalism, and, you know, I always either ignored it or sometimes just questioned it. But as I began, you know, reporting it as a book, and I, you know, thought of everything that had happened to Farzana, there was obviously a scientific and rational explanation, which is that there were terrible fires. And I obviously recount in great detail all the different kind of chemicals that abound on these mountains, such as methane and hydrogen sulfide and carbon monoxide, and, you know, many of which have tremendous ill effects on the health of waste pickers when you inhale it. So, you know, your mental development or asthma or tuberculosis, all of which impact your health. So that could be one reason that Farzana and many other waste pickers face tremendous ill health. But by the same token, when you were to think that, you know, when waste pickers continue to tell me that they saw these spirits and the spirits would trip them, you know, they could fall down on the garbage mountains or they could be possessed by spirits. The Hindus would tell me this, the Muslims would tell me this. I thought that if I was to write it, I could not just disregard what they were saying. Maybe that what they were saying also had to have a place in the narrative. And I had to give space to both the scientific or more rational, the scientific explanation for this, which could be, oh, it was plastic pollution, it was the smoke that they inhaled. But it could also be, as they said, and they had been saying for so long, that there was a shaitan which could have possessed them, or a kabis, or a whatever. So I had to give space to their narrative also. And I also thought that it was possible that these things had happened, such tremendous amount of policy delays and malaise. Like, how else are they to understand and internalize such tremendous gaps and such tremendous amount of gaps that they live in? Gaps in policy, gaps that lead to such environmental pollution that lead to such ill health, how are they to understand and explain it? And maybe this was all they fell back on the ancient myths that they knew. So yes, it's true that this is not the Islam of the book, but it's also true that these are not myths only related to the waste pickers of Deonar. These are myths that are there in the in lived Islam and also of maybe Hinduism to an extent, like the Chudail. Many Hindus believe it, while it's not there, you know, in our traditional texts, but these are beliefs. Like a shaitan is a belief that is not only among the waste pickers of Deonar, but it does exist sometimes. And these were the myths that they fell back on to rationalize what had happened to them, which was a huge policy gaps. Like, this place is 122 years old and it was supposed to close in 25 years. And the impact that it has on them, how else are they to explain it? And I had to give that equal space for their explanation of it.
It's certainly bring up the fact that so I have a few more questions now, kind of about how the government and the state, and not just them, but kind of wider Indian society, kind of intrudes on the lives of those in Deonar. The first question I have on this is kind of, you know, I noticed that, you know, most of the people you interview for the book are Muslim. And so how does religion play a role in the lives of these communities, both in terms of their daily life, but also in terms of these are people living on the fringes of an Indian city. They are also a religious minority. How do these things kind of work in tandem together for the community of waste pickers in Deonar?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would say that it's not a coincidence that they're there. As you know, I talk about it, that this place began to get, the city basically began to send pavement dwellers, street dwellers, people who lived on railway tracks to live around here from the late 60s, 70s onwards. Yeah. At that point, there were Muslims, but it was a more mixed community. There were some Hindus who lived here as well. But then, if you remember, there were when the Babri Masjid came down in 1992, there were riots, and the riots played out quite fiercely in this particular locality, and the city, Mumbai city, became quite segregated after that. And this particular area began getting increasingly segregated too, and so now after that it became quite a Muslim area. There is a particular party where that has all the corporators and the MLA and the MP, etc. And so in the city, this is seen as a Muslim area. I also found that there were waste pickers who were Muslims in other landfills in India. I found some researchers who were researching the Ahmedabad landfill, the Delhi landfill. There too, these communities are increasingly religious. Some of the characters in my book are Hindu. So I should point that out. It's not that everyone I interviewed was Muslim, but it is true that this area is Muslim. So they are here partly due to their marginalization. I did feel that the Hindus who could move out moved out, and the Muslims continued to stay here, maybe because they could not move out. And that led to an increasing marginalization, where you see that in this area, there's not enough supplies, whether it's toilets, whether it's water, whether it's electricity. And I talk in great detail about how most of the characters in this book are still buying water for their household supplies. They are still there is still very few toilets. They're using sometimes just the landfill as a toilet. So it's a vicious cycle, I would say.
So to kind of talk more about the government, Mumbai's government is like constantly trying to find a way to manage the mountain of trash, the community around it. They never seem able to follow through or willing to follow through. There's constant fights with the courts. And so kind of what was the overarching kind of like government role in looking at Deonar and in terms of the community of waste pickers that lived there?
I would say that the more more public or structured conversation around Leonard begins again post the colonial period, when these court cases, you know, of people begin in 1996. So people who lived in the more gentrified buildings near the garbage mountains filed court cases in 1996 saying, hey, this place is like, we're living near this place that is like burning and stinking and it burns all night. There's smoke emanating from these garbage mountains that just, travels into our homes and it sickens us, it causes asthma. And there's lots of doctors who then at that point documented, that there were various illnesses in this area, including respiratory illnesses, collapsed lungs, interstitial lung disease. They don't quantify it, but they certainly say that living around here causes these illnesses, or that there is a much, they do quantify that there is a much higher incidence of respiratory illnesses such as asthma, etc., in the areas, in the localities near the garbage mountains compared to those that are away from the mountains. This leads to higher mortality, leads to lower life expectancy. Like in the ward around the garbage mountains, life expectancy was 39 years in 2009 compared to 66 years for other Indians. So, certainly this has a role in the reduced life expectancy among people who live near the garbage mountains. So, they filed this court case asking the Bombay High Court that can you shut this place down? It's sickening us. It's probably killing us. And so we see the municipal response to it. And at that point, there's already 12 million metric tons of garbage lying there. These are already mountains. And in their response, I felt that you could feel the intractability, the difficulty in moving these garbage mountains. It was, in the colonial period, as I mentioned, this was a swamp. And it's almost as if when the municipality turns back to see this place, it's 12 million metric tons of garbage. It's these towering mountains. It's not easy to move them, right? It's already so difficult to move them. So they do plan from that point onwards, if not even before, they do plan to make a waste to compost plant, then they plan to make a waste to power plant. But they encounter various difficulties, including the fact that Mumbai is one of the rainiest cities in the world and the garbage is pretty soggy and is probably not going to work very well, making the viability of this plant not so great, right? So they encounter various difficulties. They do give out a contract at one point, which does not work out, and then they cancel that plant. So we see these cycles every time of them trying to do something. But in the end, that after the 2016 fires, they floated tenders to make a waste-to-power plant, which also didn't work out. That was supposed to be the country's biggest waste-to-power plant. It was a response to the epic fires that happened. They got no responses for that tender. Now they are planning to make a smaller waste to power plant, which is going to come in 2023. And I'm very hopeful. But I suppose my understanding of reading all these documents is that from 1996 onwards, when they do turn back and start looking at it, and I could read an institutional response, it seems to me that the garbage mountains were already intractable. They already seemed unmoving because there was 12 million metric tons of trash. So the municipal officials also in their responses say, this place burns in spontaneous combustion. There's so much waste, it's bound to burn. Even they see it as this thing that is intractable, unmoving. Like, how do we deal with this?
So I want to kind of ask for my last few questions, kind of going, I guess, more big picture. What gives the story of Dayanar kind of regional and global relevance? I mean, obviously, this is important for the people of Mumbai. They're kind of living with the effects, the environmental effects, the health effects of the landfill. But what is it about the story of Dayanar and those that live there that's kind of that gives it kind of wider relevance across the region and potentially the entire globe?
Yeah, sure. You know, during the reporting of this book, wherever I traveled and wherever I spoke to someone, they said, "Oh my God, this could be Moscow. So this could be Manila. This could be, you know, I'm from Italy. My editor in the US is from Italy." And she said, "Oh my God, Italy has a massive waste management problem, as you might know." When I visited New York, the so-called landfill of New York, which is Fresh Kills, was many, many times the size of Deonar. I wrote an article about it, that it is about nearly 10 times the size of Deonar. Garbage mountains rise really high and you have a view of the city from there, and there's traffic lights in there to direct the garbage trucks, which I suppose came endlessly also. The garbage mountains there swallowed the debris of the 9/11 blast, the World Trade Towers Center, basically. Anywhere in the world I went, while reporting this book, there were garbage mountain landslides in Addis Ababa that killed more than 100 waste pickers, in Colombo that also killed people. I heard endlessly about overgrown landfills in China, in Shenzhen, and different kinds of places. In Moscow, a friend of mine told me there was what they call the Mount Everest of garbage. So it seemed to me that these, our unending desires had poured out to make these garbage mountains. There was a universality to it, to our desires that made these mountains, not only in Mumbai, but elsewhere. In fact, that probably consumption and waste is many times more in other countries than it is in ours. It's just one that I live in Mumbai, so I wrote about Mumbai, but also we got to see waste pickers here and lives made of this waste. What are these lives made of? It gave a human dimension to this problem of waste, which is a global problem. Garbage mountains give out methane and carbon monoxide, which are a source of greenhouse gases and a source of climate change, etc. But sometimes we think of these as intangible things, but this provided a human, this showed lives made of waste, a human dimension to it.
So I think that's a great place to wrap. Thank you for listening to the interview with Soumya Roy, author of Mountain Tales, Love and Loss in the Municipality of Castaway Belongings. Soumya, I actually have a couple real final questions. Where can people find your work and what's next for you?
So my book is available everywhere. Books are available in bookstores, online. If you are in the US, it's called Castaway Mountain. If you are in the UK or India or something, it's called Mountain Tales. What is next for me? I am writing journalistic pieces related to my research. So I just did a piece about landfills around the world, not only in Mumbai, but like the landfill in New York and Moscow, etc. So I am, you know, looking forward to writing more pieces on this, related to waste and consumption and climate change and pollution and, you know, all of those issues that have consumed me for so many years. And I hope researchers elsewhere will also be able to use this and write about their own cities, their own countries.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at @NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find other author interviews at the New Books Network at newbooksnetwork.com. The Asian Review Books podcast is on all favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing authors writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for more info about who's coming up on the show. But before then, thank you so much, Soumya, for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me.